I don't want to scare anyone, but I'm going to give it to you straight about Jason. His body was never recovered from the lake after he drowned. 5 long years he's been dormant. Jason's out there, waiting to kill, waiting to devour, thirsty for young blood.
Greetings and salutations, dear listeners. It is us, the Hillbilly Horror Masters, here to be your guide through this year's 5 weeks of fright. I am Jesco.
And my name is Chauncey. Those of you who have maybe been listening to this show for some time may be familiar with us.
Yes, while it was just a few short years ago, we were asked by the hosts of the Radcast to tell the story of the first Thanksgiving. Then apparently they had no use for us anymore, because this is the first we're appearing in 4 years.
We chalked that up to the pandemic. Nobody wants to get COVID over the phone or email. So though it had been years of no contact, we got a call out of the blue a few weeks ago.
We may hold strange viewpoints. We may hold you closer, tiny dancer. But one thing we won't hold is a grudge.
Well said, Jesco. That being said, the guys reached out to us because the regular vampire host, Account Yuli, overslept his alarm by 3 months and had non-refundable timeshare reservations.
Who of us hasn't overslept in our coffins?
Why, our dear old grandma overslept in her coffin. She woke up on the day of her funeral.
Anyway, being the understanding and handsome and single guys they are, the twins let him take his vacation and they contacted us. So over the next 5 weeks, we will be sharing various hillbilly tales of horror we've accrued over the years.
So sit back and relax before the main event. And we warm you up like a can of beans over a tire fire. Take it away, Jesco.
Submitted for the approval of the Midnight Society, I call this The Tale of Farmer Mel and the Muckman. The year was 1966. Batman starring Adam West started airing on CBS. Figure skater Peggy Fleming won a championship, and on this particular occasion, Farmer Mel Montrose was down on his luck. Years earlier, Farmer Mel sunk every last dime of his family's inheritance into a business that made elixirs that promised the consumer would develop gills. That way, Mel could frolic around with the fish in the creek. This upset his family for several reasons, one of which was neither of his parents were dead yet. Now, just a few short years later, Mel found himself middle-aged and broke, with nothing to his name except a rusty pocket knife and a canoe. Determined to pull himself up by his loafers, Mel set out every day into the marshy wetlands miles from his parents' property, in order to capture whatever marine life he could so he could make himself some assorted juices to sell.
"These juices will make me a rich man one day," he proclaimed to no one in particular.
However, on this fateful day, Farmer Mel Montrose would find himself in for more than he bargained for. It was an overcast Wednesday in September, and it was unusually chilly for that area during that time of year. Mel's boat sat still atop the swamp water, and its net tangled up beside him. Mel Montrose was napping in his boat when he was awakened by a grumbling noise. He shot up, startled by the noise out into the distance. There was more of a haze covering the bog than there was when he fell asleep. He looked left and right, even squinting his eyes to try and see through the screen of smoke.
Must be a storm coming, he muttered to himself, and he put the hood of his jacket over his head. Just when Mel tried to fall back asleep, he heard the rumbling again, only louder this time. Tarnation, he exclaimed. That don't sound to me like no storm rumblings I ever heard. Another rumble rolled through, only this time it was accompanied by groans and guttural noises, not common to any mere human. Mel was fully alert at this point and knew if the water around him were to stop bubbling, then he could encounter the dreaded Muckman. Around these parts, history had spoken of a vile creature, 6 feet 6 inches tall, caked and dripping with mud and mire from the swamp. He had large gnashing teeth affixed into a crooked mouth with an overbite, his eyes beady and red, and a human mustache. The tales of the Muckman were told to children who misbehaved. The Muckman would be summoned by frustrated parents and would be called upon to take their children's toys and eat them in front of the kids. Around Christmas time, the Muckman could be summoned by Santa to punish bad children by spanking them. Santa was also known to have wanted to be spanked bare-bottom by the Muckman. But that's just speculation. Anyway, Mel Montrose believed them legends to be true and felt he may have an encounter with the Muckman very soon. The noises persisted, groaning and growling, rumbling and grumbling, echoing through the trees. Just then the bubbling started. One, then two, then a dozen, then a baker's dozen, until finally Farmer Montrose was surrounded by the waters bubbling rapidly like a hot tub. Mel was panicking. He felt sick to his stomach. The queasy feeling of impending doom washed over his body. The sound grew louder as he could feel the beast getting closer. Moaning and groaning, growling, rumbling and grumbling. The bubbles grew more rapid, and Mel felt like they were consuming him. His stomach tied in knots. Sweat dripped from his forehead. Dear God, protect me from the clutches of the dreaded Muckman, he cried. I'm sorry for my trespasses against thou. Please, Lord, forgive us my past transgressions. Please don't let the Muckman consume me under his slimy breast. I'll make sure to make my marine life juices in your name. Amen and woman.
The boat started to shake. All the noises culminated at once into a cacophony looming over Mel Montrose. Every fiber in his body tightened, his heart raced, and the discomfort in his stomach made it feel like it was pulsing. The bubbling and the guttural noises almost became too much to bear. Mel Montrose dropped to his knees, bent his body over and covered his head and his neck, his rear end pointed skyward, ready for whatever the monster would do. Right when the situation became too much to take, Mel Montrose's body had a sudden forceful release of tension. The knots in his stomach loosened, and the queasiness he felt rushed out of his body at once. A loud, low bellow rang throughout the swamp. The sound went on for what seemed like minutes, fluctuating in pitch and girth. The boat shook as the moment persisted. A violent movement of the bubbles sent them 2, maybe 3 feet into the air, and the dirty water showered over Mel. He continued in his fetal position, his body energy emptying. Then, as suddenly as it began, it stopped. The loud bellowing finished with a high-pitched squeak. The waters quieted. The haze lifted, and there was nothing but serenity. Mel Montrose slowly gathered himself and got upright again. He looked around and found nothing. No remnant of a monster. No residual effect of some creature. Just calm. Mel felt lighter, like he had just survived an insurmountable situation. He had a new lease on life. He paddled his way to land, bound and determined to tell people of what had happened. Needless to say, no one believed he faced the Muckman and lived to tell the tale. Even when he told the church he believed it to be an angel matching the monster's noises, fighting the Muckman above the boat, they told him to get a new religion. So for years, Mel Montreux maintained he had an experience of biblical proportions that the Lord sent to protect her. Then one day, Farmer Mel Montreux disappeared, never to be heard from again.
Ooh, wow, that was quite a yarn, Jesco.
I have a question, though. With him going into such great detail and describing it how it's described in the story, what could it have possibly been?
Well, many people he told believed it to have just been gas.
Never underestimate the power of a righteous booty burp.
Yes, that is my favorite Bible verse. Another thing to never underestimate is a mother's love and her son's hunger for vengeance. That was at least the initial theme of this week's sequel.
Years after the events of the first film, a camp close to Camp Crystal Lake is hosting counselor training. However, they'll be in more than they bargained for when the camp legend appears to them in the flesh. It's Friday the 13th, Part 2. Stay tuned, boys and ghouls. The Radcast will be right back.
I told the others. They didn't believe me.
I know what you're on.
You're all doomed.
You're
all doomed.
Ah, it's finally that time.
Finally.
Finally that time of year.
We count down the day every year. Mm-hmm. This is the time we look forward to, not just in our personal lives, but for the show.
Yeah, exactly.
We get a chance to welcome some guests every year that we don't usually get to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and usually it's our pal Count Yuli, but mm-hmm. Apparently he overslept his alarm. But that's okay. Let him go out on vacation.
Non-refundable timeshares,
wherever it's at. But we're happy to have Jesco and Chauncey this year.
Of course.
Hopefully you, the listener, will be happy to hear some of their tales of their hillbilly dumb or like, whatever they've heard, wherever they've lived.
It's very much like a hillbilly Twilight Zone.
And
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
Yeah, it's
also,
mix of these things.
Yeah.
But you have us right now. Welcome back into the Radcast, everybody. It is that time of year again. Mm. It is 5 weeks of Fright 3,
the triumphant return of five weeks of Fright.
Exactly. Last year we only did 4 weeks, which would have made it just Radcast Halloween,
which is what it was.
Which, that's fine. We had a great time.
Radcast Halloween.
We had a great time.
It's fine. Okay.
We still say it's okay. Everybody, calm down. Yeah. It's all right. No need to write your local politicians or whatever.
Yeah.
But we are back right now. Back to it being 5 weeks of Fright proper, and we decided this year that outside of a six mix that we have planned
mm-hmm.
with the returning guest Jeremy Weed.
Yep.
We're going to talk about some of the other Friday the 13th movies.
Yeah. One of my favorite horror series.
Mm-hmm.
We're not horror guys. It's really only this time of year that we actually dig into,
mm-hmm.
that we actually like watch horror movies and stuff. And usually it's like the big names.
Yeah. And I'm fascinated by the mindset of fans of horror. Mm-hmm. I'm fascinated by mainly 80s horror, but there's stuff from the 70s, stuff from the 90s that they're fun to get into. But like anything else, for the most part, I want to have fun. I want to enjoy when I watch a movie. Those are some of my favorites. We love the Academy Award winning stuff. I love the stuff that makes you think. But at the end of the day, sometimes you just want to have fun.
I just want to watch movies that entertain me.
Yeah, and these 80s slashers are fun, including the Friday the 13th
mm-hmm.
movies. So last year we did Friday the 13th, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And
1 year we just ranked the movies.
Yeah, this year we're doing 2, 3, 4, and 6.
Yep.
And one of the reasons was there's a Friday the 13th in October.
Yes,
this
there is.
Year.
Yep.
Yep. So we're excited for that. So Friday the 13th Part 2, we're starting 5 weeks of Fright 3
mm-hmm.
with that one.
Yep.
So let's get into some of the ins and outs of the movie Friday the 13th Part 2, released May 1st, 1981, directed by...
But you can find us.
Oh, yes. Yes, please.
Yes.
Please. Go find us here.
Yeah. You can find us in all previous 5 weeks of Frights. And this week's 5 weeks mm-hmm. of Fright and all of our episodes, you can find us on every podcast app, mm-hmm. your Spotify, Stitchers, not Stitcher anymore.
Yeah, not Stitcher anymore.
But everywhere else. And you can find us on Instagram. We're at the Radcast. Radcast is all one word. Cast is spelled with a K. That's it. All right, proceed.
Yes. So Friday the 13th Part 2, released May 1st, 1981, directed by Steve Miner, starring Amy Steele as Jenny, John Furey is Paul, Stu Charno is Ted, Bill Randolph is Jeff, Marta Kober is Sandra, Lauren Marie Taylor is Vicky, Tom McBride is Mark, Russell Todd is Scott, Kirsten Baker is Terry, Warrington Gillette and Steve Dash as Jason, with Walt Gorney as
Crazy. They weren't twins.
No, they're not.
It's not like an Olsen twins scenario where they had to switch out because of child labor laws.
No, they had to switch out because one of them wasn't up for the task. But the one not up for the task was the one credited as Jason.
Yeah.
That being Warrington Gillette.
He wasn't as experienced as a stuntman, so he wouldn't do most stunts. So the one who did most stunts was Steve Dash.
Yep. And they're both Jason, both credited as Jason later.
Yeah.
But with Walt Gorney coming back as Crazy Ralph, Adrian King coming back as Alice, and Betsy Palmer coming back as Mrs. Voorhees, of course, in a limited capacity for all three of them.
Yep. As you'll hear in a second.
Yeah, as you'll hear, box office of $21.7 million on a $1.2 million budget. What was on the VHS? So it was a late 90s release, which showcases Paramount films like Night at the Roxbury, Wayne's World, Clueless, Beavis and Butthead Do America, Black Sheep, Coneheads, Tommy Boy, Grease, and Pretty in Pink, with scenes from each movie made into a montage done to We Got the Beat by the Go-Go's.
Yeah.
The way I found out what song it was is I had to turn up my TV all the way to hear the video, because whoever was filming this off their TV must have not wanted to wake their parents.
Probably not.
So low.
Yeah.
Next, an advertisement for a show called Bob and Margaret, which was based off of an Academy Award-winning short called Bob's Birthday. It's a cartoon couple that goes through middle age, marital ups and downs, the ins and outs of their lives. It's more adult oriented. Mm-hmm. It's actually a British show that was on for 8 years.
Really?
So
this
is
the first I'm ever hearing of it.
Yeah. So I looked it up and I was like, when was this canceled? It's like, oh no, it went on for 8 years.
Huh.
So good for them.
Yeah.
So Friday the 13th Part 2 was originally a movie that wasn't supposed to be made.
No, of course not. Like, it's like the Halloween sequel, mm-hmm. and it's like the Nightmare on Elm Street sequel. It's like most of those iconic horror movies mm-hmm. that got kind of lackluster sequels, there's a reason they're all lackluster. It's because the directors intended to tell one story mm-hmm. in one movie,
yeah.
and there was a finality to it, except for the first Halloween that was kind of shrouded in mystery,
mm-hmm.
And I guess the first Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
But this one, the very first Friday the 13th, it's done. Like,
the story's
over.
Was told.
Yeah. All the characters except the final girl are dead.
Mm-hmm.
Your villain is dead.
Mm-hmm.
What else are you going to do?
Yeah. And, like, this is really the dawning of the slasher age.
Yeah.
Which I think we mentioned last year. The credit is given in part to Halloween.
Yeah.
And establishing some of those slasher tropes.
Black Christmas.
Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah.
Some of the earlier entries into the horror world as influences, and then you have Friday the 13th, which kind of in a way establishes some sort of formula or format that Friday the 13th Part 2 kind of, you know, further fleshes out,
mm-hmm.
and then they lean hard into it in later sequels.
Yeah.
But this is why I say all that, because then it really weren't any horror sequels or sequels to slasher movies at this time. Because also, the slasher genre, so many films had been made after Friday the 13th mm-hmm. to copy off Halloween.
Sure. It's cheap.
You
can make it quick.
You can get, you know, your audience, you know, teenagers, young adults in the theaters mm-hmm. fast.
Because you understand the appeal. It's like mm-hmm. kind of over-the-top violence mm-hmm. and sex.
Yep, exactly. So they use that formula. They use, you know, to varying degrees of quality.
Yeah.
But
some leaned into it heavier than others. This one is a sequel that, like, the further sequels mm-hmm. would lean into it. This one still is kind of more reserved like the first one.
Yeah, but unlike some of the copycats, there was actually the studios like Paramount and also when Halloween was released, they wanted sequels because they saw the financial benefit to some of these. You know, Friday the 13th was like an indie movie.
Yeah.
And it was distributed by Paramount after they got the film rights. And the Paramount saw there could be money to be made because it absolutely, you know, tripled, quadrupled their budget with their box office return, that they're like, okay, So they quickly put one into production, and then that would just lead to years of them, you know, not even, you know,
just disregard some sort of canonical timeline.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you would have sequels coming out 9-10 months after the last one because they're like, all right, start production on the next Friday sequel.
Yeah.
So that's essentially what this was, but like I said earlier, it wasn't supposed to happen because Sean Cunningham and Tom Savini, Betsy Palmer, a lot of people who worked on the first movie were like,
it's over.
It's over. What do you need a sequel for?
Yeah.
Oh, Jason?
Yeah.
You mean the kid that was mentioned sporadically throughout the movie who ended up, it was his mom who was the killer who's dead? What do you mean, Jason?
Yes.
Like, and Jason's the killer in this one?
Yeah, if you're not familiar with the series as a whole, like we said, we did an episode about the first one last year, but just so you don't have to go back and listen to that one, the first Friday the 13th, Jason is not the killer. Mm-hmm. His mom, Pamela Voorhees, is the killer. Mm-hmm. Jason is just a little boy who drowned in Camp Crystal Lake due to negligence from camp counselors. Mm-hmm. And his mom is the one that went on the rampage killing counselors. Mm-hmm. Revenge for Jason.
Mm-hmm.
So it's established that Jason drowned. He's dead. Like, Jason is just mentioned in name only as a legend or like a cautionary tale and as Pamela Voorhees' motivation.
Mm-hmm.
He's my son. He wasn't a very good swimmer. He
wasn't a very good swimmer. But it, I mean, also he, and it's kind of, there's the first 12, 13 minutes of the movie is essentially we follow the final girl from the first film, Alice, who is now recovering from the traumas that came about her, trying to recover, get her life back together. And it's just her essentially lying on a bed in a giant house, reliving and through a nightmare, kind of the final act of
recapping
the first movie. It's recapping it, and kind of the big emphasis is put on one of the bigger twists, or one of the jump scares at the end, the classic jump scare of just apparently a child just covered in just river slime and then grime and pulling her under.
It's supposed to be like the visage of Jason coming and like avenging himself.
Yeah, its only purpose in the first movie was to kind of just leave a mark on audiences,
which it still has an effect today. If you don't know it's coming, it's still done so effectively.
Yeah,
although you listening now know it happens.
So. Yeah, exactly. The films are over forty years old. The first couple are.
Yeah, but then they try and convey that like it was a dream.
Yeah,
she's like, "What about the boy in the lake?" And he's like, "Ma'am, we found no boy, you know, whatever."
She's like, "But she's still out there." And then her end of her nightmare before she shoots awake is just a repeating of, "He's still out there. Yeah. So I was like, "Oh, okay." So I guess that's a way they'll kind of rein in the idea of, it's possible Jason is out there now. And that kind of it before also we get to Paul, the lead, kind of the guy who's going to be training the counselors. There's the famous scene in the campfire where he's kind of giving the exposition of like the urban legend of Jason and how
his body was never discovered.
Yeah, so the legend goes he's still alive and he watched his mom get beheaded and now he's out for blood and blah,
to which
blah, blah.
I was like, that's what he establishes is like, oh, the legend has it. He just kind of lived off wildlife and like lived in the woods and stuff. I was like, what was keeping him from coming back to his mom though?
Yeah.
Like going to his mom, like, what was he waiting for?
Mm-hmm.
How did he get out of the lake?
Yeah.
He couldn't swim. Like, there are questions that I just raised, and they don't actually bother me because it introduces us to Jason Voorhees as the killer, and he would permeate pop culture, and he would become an icon and a legend. So it allows us to get to that, to him as the killer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because they're trying to establish a sequel on a story that's over already.
Yeah.
And they're trying to do with a character that we've already established isn't around.
Mm-hmm.
It's gonna, no matter how you slice, you're gonna do it clumsily. So
yeah,
I'm glad they did it, but still, it's like, why was he just living by himself as a little boy? Why didn't he try and go find his mom? What was keeping him from that? Clearly, they established he watched his mom get beheaded, which then that's his motive now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, it just raises a lot of questions.
It's a huge jump in logic that people like I mentioned earlier, Tom Savini, who worked on the special effects, the director Sean Cunningham, Betsy Palmer and people who worked on the first movie. It's a jump in logic they didn't want to try and like justify. So yeah. Like our story is told. Yeah. So Paramount was like, okay, we'll find different people. We'll find different people mm-hmm. to direct, we'll find different people to write it. And that's what they did. Now to kind of step back a little bit. Now, as far as the sequel goes, some of the people who worked on the original were like, okay, sequel, why don't we make it like an anthology series?
Yeah. Like kind of like how Halloween 3 mm-hmm. tried to do with the Halloween mm-hmm. series.
Yeah, like there's a different event that happens each year on Friday the 13th. We can still, you know, reach slasher quotas. We can mm-hmm. still reach horror quotas. We can tell different stories that, you know, can have teenagers excited to see that every year. But yeah. No, the bigwigs at Paramount wanted to keep it kind of centered, that camp setting,
yeah.
adjacent, not adjacent, adjacent to Camp Crystal Lake.
Yeah.
So they don't make it at Camp Crystal Lake. They make it across the lake from Camp Crystal Lake. There's yeah. this summer camp counselor training going on, yeah. being led by this guy, Paul. And that's where we get introduced to our victims. You know, it's this slew of camp counselors,
teenagers, yeah.
the
or
bodies.
Are they established as teenagers or the young adults? Or,
I think they're young. Summer,
which doesn't really matter. But
it doesn't really matter. And that also goes to show that as the later movies went on, there was and in this one too, there's kind of not a whole lot of depth giving to certain characters. Uh-uh. Which of course, if you're gonna have 10 people that you give lines to or showcase
yeah.
just to be bodies. In the wake of Jason, you know, you're not going to spend in a 90-minute movie, you're not going to spend all the time in the world to develop 10 people. You'll focus on two or three, one of them being the final girl. However, it is a better movie. I feel like it's a better movie than the first one. It's more enjoyable to watch. The first one, I think we talked about last year, it's just kind of boring.
Yeah.
Outside of the twist of Mrs. Voorhees, the jump scare, and kind of...
It's them just milling around being mm-hmm. stalked by someone in the shadows.
Yeah. So this one, at least it's a little more entertaining to watch the dialogue. Yeah. I feel like, there's not a whole lot you can ask for. It still leaves some to be desired. However, the dialogue is fine. Dynamic and characters is fine. They do give a little bit of characterization to people as opposed to you're all nameless, faceless teenagers.
Oh, sure.
So there's some defining character traits to some people, but it's still just teenagers, young adults who are there.
But they seem more relatable,
mm-hmm.
just kind of thing. Like usually like, lending to the suspense portion of it, the first half an hour
mm-hmm.
of these movies, just about give or take, is usually just counselor stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're just walking around, hanging out and conversing with each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's done to sort, while they're being stalked in the shadows, you get the behind Harry mm-hmm. Manfredini's score. And I think the idea is just to, like, spend time with them and mm-hmm. develop a connection.
Yeah.
So like, and so you can relate to them, and it makes their deaths more impactful.
Mm-hmm.
The only deaths that occur to kind of show you of this force of nature that's going around are like the occasional townsperson
mm-hmm.
or like a police officer. It's not always the case, but definitely like the first couple of these movies.
Mm-hmm.
And can kind of like we mentioned, we're probably going to keep mentioning as we get to later sequels, the slasher genre in the 80s basically became about how creative they can make kills and how many sex mm-hmm. scenes and boobies we can show.
Yeah.
So some characters are pretty much there only for that purpose.
Right.
Like when the later sequel, when you introduce someone who basically could have no name because
mm-hmm.
like a character might say, hey, Justin or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time they die, you can be like, I had no connection to that person because they were there just to be
mm-hmm.
a doofus or whatever. So in the later ones, counselors go from being regular teenagers
mm-hmm.
who are harmless, but they still desire, because they're teenagers, they desire to engage in those indulgences. And it shifts to the characters just become cartoonish depictions of horny, dumb teenagers whose purpose in
mm-hmm.
the movie is to have sex and be killed in an over-the-top way.
Mm-hmm.
Which, from the side characters, I prefer just from a comedic standpoint.
Yeah, exactly.
I like how over the top
mm-hmm.
and ridiculous and self-aware the slasher movies would become.
Yeah. They do start to know what they are. Like you said, self-aware. This one, I feel like, still tries to be an earnest film. Not an earnest film. But like, it still tries to be a film. The first one, I think, definitely tried to do that with suspense elements, with what would be determined as slasher elements.
Yeah.
It was like a murder mystery.
Yeah, it's close. This one's as close to a carbon copy. You know, you had Friday the 13th knockoffs. Mm-hmm. This one's probably the most accurate Friday the 13th knockoff.
Yeah.
Just happens to be a Friday the 13th movie.
Exactly.
It sticks pretty close to the previous film's formula.
Yeah. And the first one was different in the fact that there was really a surprise that it was this supposedly kind old woman who was doing all this killing. So it made it different from a lot of slashers and the copycats. This one, they start to establish, okay, now let's make it some voyeuristic brute,
lumbering monster
who stalks these people and kill and just knocks them off all in, you know, still relatively as creative ways. But it's all gruesome.
Yeah.
But like you said, as long in the later sequels and in later slasher movies, as long as you hit the TNA, as long as you have, you know, high swearing count, you know, you have the comic relief, you have some funny dynamic between a character or two, and you have a final girl. And as long as the kills are creative,
the audience
will enjoy it, and they're not really.
No one cares about, you know, character development.
They don't care about
story.
They don't care about pathos.
Yeah, none of that stuff.
And that's okay.
That's perfectly. I like that. That's why I like 80s slashers, because they're so ridiculous and bombastic, and like they know what they are, and they make no apologies for it.
Exactly. But in this one, with it still, I guess it seemed like it still tried to be.
Yeah.
You know, a movie to be taken seriously, it wasn't, and that's okay too. But what they did is they built upon and kind of bettered a lot of what the first one was lacking, which is what you want in a sequel. And like we said earlier, it introduced the one of the most iconic horror characters in Jason Voorhees.
Yeah, however, he does not have the hockey mask yet.
No,
it is not until part three.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a bag over his head.
Mm-hmm. Why do you have a bag on your head,
Grinch? He's got one eye hole.
Yeah.
So kind of a take on the movie The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's supposed to be this this hermit in the woods who he's just trying to protect his territory.
And he keeps his mom's severed head in his
little
living room.
Yeah. He built himself a nice shack inside the woods that has plumbing.
Assumed he did all this as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. See, again, it's just so like, let's just accept Jason's here.
Yeah.
He's the killer.
Mm-hmm.
He's the guy that's going to carry the franchise. We acknowledge that sequel's not supposed to happen. We're just going to accept all this ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
And let's keep moving.
Another thing that this did that kind of one of the more notorious things with the Friday the 13th movies is the time jump.
Yeah.
Because at least with Alice at the beginning gets killed.
Yeah.
Like this is where we see Jason's kind of first murder. It's this shadowy figure who pops up, and he left his mother's severed head in Alice's fridge.
Yeah, she's just keeping it cold for him.
Yeah, exactly.
She left it there for him to come retrieve.
Yes, exactly, which is nice. And he gives her the old ice pick to the temple for her misdeeds.
Yeah, it's called an Irish thank you.
Yeah, exactly. he takes the boiling water off the burner, which is nice of him.
That's what I was like, that's nice. It doesn't overflow, and he didn't turn the stove off, but it's fine.
No, but he's a nice guy,
though. He's very considerate.
Yes, exactly. Jason's very considerate.
He is. He's a little boy in arrested development, trapped in a man's body, as our heroine, as this movie's heroine would explore. Which kind of separates her from every quote unquote final girl, last girl, heroine of horror movies and stuff. She sets herself apart.
Yeah. And before we get to Jenny, real quick, again, one of the more notorious things that they're known for is the time jumps. This takes place 5 years after the events of the first one, which would put us technically in 1984. And this movie came out in 1981.
Yeah.
And then that just continues throughout the series. So we're finally, like, the last one time-wise, it's supposed to take place in the late 90s, but it was made in 1990, 1991.
Yeah.
But,
or in space.
Yes. That's
Jason X.
Yes, although the timelines are mixed up, you can reset everything with space.
Yeah, exactly.
Time doesn't work the same out in space.
Yeah, exactly.
But Jenny, the character of Jenny, which is a welcome difference. I mean, character of Alice was fine. She was more meek and timid, but held her own at the end.
That's kind of it's more of a progression with the final girl, like Laurie Strode.
Yeah.
Like unassuming, you said meek, timid, and then they build up the courage and the strength to take on this, you know, this entity,
force,
which is still is commendable. Like that's still awesome.
Yeah.
And that's something to be like, yeah, you know, you see that arc. Jenny comes in and she's like, she's a smart ass.
Yeah.
She's intelligent.
She's tough.
She's independent.
Tough.
She doesn't take shit.
Even before she takes on Jason, which shows a different kind of strength when she fights back with him, like
with this child psychology,
because
she's studying child psychology. Yeah.
And there's this scene after the first or second day of training, the counselor's pulse.
But she's nice. She's not.
She's not unlikable.
Yeah, but she's perfectly capable. And she's like, I can take care of myself, kind of thing.
And it's established that she and Paul have some sort of romantic connection.
They have good chemistry.
Yeah. So the movie, it starts with like eight counselors. We see eight, nine counselors. And then all these other extras. And then some of the counselors, Jenny, Paul, Ted,
Jeff,
Ted,
Sandra.
There's all them. I'm talking about people when they're going
Terry,
into town.
Mark.
Terry, put it in reverse, Terry.
Yeah.
But people like, they're all of them, the people who are given names in the credits, they all get killed.
Yeah.
But Paul, Jenny.
Ted doesn't get killed.
Exactly. But Ted, his name's Ted, right?
Because he does the jokes and stuff.
Yeah, because there's Ned, Ted,
Jed,
Led, Bed. Red, but they, because last year or
Muhammad,
yes, Ted, Paul, Jenny, and some of the other counselors go into town.
Yeah.
One last hurrah before they really get down to business and train in the counselor training.
In the extras,
in the extras. That's what I said.
Yes,
but some people stay back, like.
Terry, Sandra, Jeff, Mark,
Vicky. Cassandra and Jeff are together, and they're told not to go to Camp Crystal Lake because Paul, that's one of the rules. It's Paul like, has this.
Don't go over there.
Yeah, he there's a scene at the campfire where they're given this exposition. He's given this explanation as to like how Jason would still be alive and the lore of this movie. And then Ted jumps out and scares everybody and blah blah blah.
Which he proposes it like just a tall tale.
Yeah,
because once Ted jumps out and scares everyone, he's like, all right, no, like. They like that camp closed down 5 years ago, you know, X, Y, and Z. There is no Jason, like none of that stuff.
Yeah. And then, but the next day, Jeff and Sandra find their way over because there's a lot we're going on out of order. Jeff and Sandra are the two counselors we first see before the meetup with Ted. And like when the three of them show up, Sandra sees the Camp Crystal Lake.
Yeah. You've got it's the scene of all the counselors making their way to the camp.
Yeah.
And we're introduced to them as the audience, and then you've got they're all meeting up in a small town, and the townies are like the dreaded, you know, the tale of Camp Crystal Lake, and they're like, Crazy Ralph shows
he's like, they didn't listen to me, you know, the others didn't listen to me, you're all doomed, just like the last movie. But
so that gets us to this point.
Fast forward, Jeff and Sandra are curious about Camp Crystal Lake,
yeah.
and they make their way in the woods. On their way over there, they get stopped by some deputy.
Some dumpy deputy.
Yeah, some idiot.
Dumpy deputy sounds like a cartoon character.
Yeah. Thank you, Hanna-Barbera. But because of this, they're punished, I guess, quote unquote, punished by Paul. And they say, you two can't go into town with us because of your stunt earlier.
Yeah.
And then Scott stays because he wants to get closer to Terry because he's antagonizing her, being a misogynistic
pig. He's a nice perv.
Yeah, he's a nice perv. Vicky stays because Mark, who's in a wheelchair, she has a crush on him.
Yeah.
So all of them stay, and these are the victims. These are Jason's next victims, who we see dispatched of in relatively creative ways.
Yeah.
The gore is significantly less seen on screen by the audience, but it wasn't significantly less in the making. It's just Paramount got away with, or the movie got away with a lot of the gore the last time. Because the studio, you know, didn't know what they had.
Yeah.
Now they knew what they had and cracked down on it. So I think Steve Miner had to send it back over a dozen times.
Oh, yeah. That's a common story you will hear because we got a lot of information from the documentary Crystal Lake Memories.
Fantastic.
Which is excellent. Well,
I think in every one of these episodes where we've showcased these movies, I can't recommend enough if you have 7 hours to kill.
Yeah.
Crystal Lake Memories.
You have to watch it all in one sitting.
Yeah. It's a fantastic documentary.
Very good. That's a similar story in these movies. It's similar in the Freddy movies, as we heard in Never Sleep Again, which is a Nightmare on Elm Street documentary.
Another one.
If you have 4 hours, you can watch that too. That's what happens a lot. You get a lot. They hire on these just ingenious makeup artists that come up with the most ridiculous, over-the-top kind of stuff. Just kind of like, this is their playground and they're doing it for fun, and they go and they're like, none of this is real. Like, it just, this is what it is, and the joy I have is coming up with like the most absurd, creative, gruesome way to kill someone. They wear it like a badge of honor. And so you constantly hear these stories of like a makeup artist or a producer or someone on the film who was involved with the death scene. They're like, oh yeah, we had all this and this, and you know, but obviously it was too over the top, so you'll never get to see it, but man, we had some ingenious contraptions set up to create this effect. And just to highlight to the ingenuity of practical effects and the makeup artists and stuff like that, and experience, like we mentioned in the first Friday the 13th movie, Tom Savini was a war photographer in Vietnam, so he had a lot of personal experience with the gruesome reality of that kind of stuff. But yeah, that's a common story, is you get constantly, they're like, well, you know, our edit is what you saw, but here's what we had, and it was so awesome.
Yeah, and with things like later media releases of them, and then now with the Scream Factory, which is a subsidiary of Shout Factory, which Shout Factory is fantastic as well. But Scream Factory 2020, they released a giant box set of all the Friday the 13th.
I have it.
Yeah.
Blu-ray.
It's really, really cool.
It's awesome. The box art is cool.
Yeah, I think Crystal Lake Memories is on there
It is not.
Maybe in parts, because in later DVD releases after Crystal Lake Memories, they released like whichever part of Crystal Lake Memories was.
Oh, like in the extra features.
In 2000 and... Or in a later release of this... That section of Crystal Lake Memories, that part of the documentary, is on the special features.
Yeah.
There have been several documentaries about the Friday the 13th series. I think Crystal Lake Memories
is
the
most comprehensive.
Best. Yeah.
I think
so. In later releases, like on the Shout or on the Scream Factory box set, the special effects artist had an old, kind of worn out VHS for his own portfolio of his work on this movie.
Yeah.
So they commissioned a cleanup for the deleted scenes, and they, except one, which the woman who played Sandra lied, and they realized she was 17 and she had a nude scene, and they were like, we can't put that. So it was filmed, but they were like, we can't put that in the movie, because they found out after they filmed it that she was underage. And then also it was never restored. Right. But all the other deleted scenes, I think, have had a 4K scan and have been put on the special features
later,
which has been done for several other of these movies.
Yeah.
So
you
fans,
can have your cake and eat it too.
Yes. Now fans get some of the most comprehensive of the movies, because now you can have these deleted scenes that were stuff of legend that maybe you just read about in Fangoria or on early websites and message boards in the infancy of the internet in the late 90s and 2000s.
Yeah.
So that's really cool about like what once was lost to time. Some stuff's still lost to time.
Yeah.
But what once was thought to be lost to, like, lost to time is restored now.
Yeah.
But back to the movie and back to the significance of the scene where they go into the bar, it shows in the bar, you know, there's all these patrons, all these extras of this small town or whatever, but we see Ted, Paul, and Ginny at the bar, and they're a few beers deep each.
Yeah.
And Paul and Ted are going back and forth about something, but Ginny's still stuck on the lore and the story of Jason. She's like, what if Jason,
let's
isn't
think
a
beyond
legend.
The legend. Let's put this in real terms.
Yeah.
You know, what would he be like today?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of thing.
You know, you're fine. I mean, it's still the idea, like you said, this would be somebody who, you know, essentially is an orphan, someone who had to raise themselves in the woods, someone who didn't have a mother around, someone who was alone, someone who is in a state of arrested development, this now giant human being, if it's supposed to be this huge figure who lurks and stalks in the woods, he still has the mindset of a child. Like, her book learning on child psychology, which she's majoring in, like, it causes this curiosity for her. Like you said, she poses these questions to Ted and Paul, who just write her off, and they're like, you know, let it go. It's just a legend.
And she, like, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna finish. I just was gonna say, legend or not, she's just curious, like this case study of this individual.
Oh, sure. Even before, like, the grief of having to deal with him being all alone, he's this child with this deformed face, and so he's bullied, and so his mom is his only friend, and so, like, so seeing her die must have, like, destroyed him, and so she was seeking revenge for him out of love, and that's kind of what Ginny pointed out. She's like, she loved him, and she was killing people, but she did it out of love, which I know is morbid, but like, she reasons that maybe he just feels abandoned and alone, and he's waiting for his mother to return. Like, she brings up, like, he's waiting for this resurrection, which kind of foreshadows later and how she baits Jason into kind of trusting her to where she can, like, kill him, to which we'll, you know, talk about that. But like, she attempts to humanize him. She doesn't look at him like a monster, which is so three-dimensional. And even the most popular horror movie, Final Girls, Heroines, all that stuff, there hasn't really been one up to this point, and even a little after, that showed that much depth. Like, she's from, like we mentioned, from the beginning, she's, like, strong and capable. She doesn't get that way, kind of thing. And the fact that she tried to humanize this monster really speaks volumes to Ginny as a character.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think that's one of the more likable parts about her, and that's what has made her a fan favorite, is being portrayed so well and convincingly by Amy Steele, who would leave acting and become a family and marriage therapist.
Oh, yeah, which she kind of regrets, not because she got offered the third one.
Yeah.
And she was like, nah, because she didn't want to be pigeonholed. So she kind of just waited on to get, like, more roles and stuff, and that never happened. And she's like, shoot, I should have done the third one.
Yeah, but it's cool that art imitates life, because you can also tell that Amy Steele convincingly brings that to life, because maybe she has that interest.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting thing to, like you said, try and humanize someone who, at that point, legend or not, for them, the irony for the audience is they see he's not a legend.
Yeah.
He's very real.
Yes.
But to them at the bar, he's still a legend, but it's just wild it's crazy to Paul and Ted that she's trying to. Yeah.
Why are you still you're trying to reason this out, and there's no reason to.
Just like there's no reason for a number two.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the story was told number one. Neither here nor there on that.
Yeah.
We're already firmly established.
We're done with that.
By that time, we're already firmly established into the second one.
Yeah, exactly.
But Paul and Ginny decide that they want to leave, because Ted's like, another round. And and Jenny's like, none for me. And then finally she's like, you know, let's go. And Ted decides to stay, and because he decided to stay and get drunk, he never got killed.
He died.
He
survived.
They left that for Christine when he gets crushed by the car.
Yeah, exactly. But we have to mention, because we've grazed very briefly over the counselors. They're not as inconsequential as we kind of made it.
Yeah, and that's...
It's kind of like we mentioned, these movies spend like the first 25, 30 minutes just hanging out with them so we can get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the most famous kills in the entire series, probably in horror movie history, is Mark, who's in a wheelchair, is going to find Vicky because they agreed to spend the night together. Mm-hmm. And she's since been killed, or she hasn't been killed yet, but she went off to her cabin to go find stuff. And like, he hears a noise, like as you do in horror movies. And he's like, "Vicky, is that you?" Like, "Vicky." Mm-hmm. And from out of nowhere, you see a hand into the frame and a machete go into his face.
Yeah.
And what makes this so famous is that he's rolling backwards, and you get a wide shot because he's in a wheelchair, and you get a wide shot, and he's just rolling down a flight of steps.
Yeah.
And I think, given how controversial it is, and given the circumstances of the character and all that stuff, it's just become a really famous shot. Mm-hmm. That wide shot of him, you know, flying down the steps, and it quickly cuts away, and it can be understandably
upsetting
to people, but it's often seen as a very iconic kind of kill. That and like the sleeping bag kill in the seventh one.
Another one is, there's of course the scene where two characters are having sex, and this time it's Sandra and Jeff, and Jeff's on top of her, and Jason
it's the only instance of a character's having sex in this movie.
Yeah.
Which would change with the later sequels, like we mentioned, how that's all they had.
Yeah.
That was like the appeal.
Yeah. And the spear that Ted, you know, used to like scare everybody earlier, he had like a mask on and a loincloth. Yeah. Jason takes it and he skewers both Jeff and Sandra.
Yeah.
He kebabs them.
And I have all the kills in here, too.
And that's another famous one, which people think, you know, was stolen from the Mario Bava movie.
Twitch of the Death from 71.
Yeah.
So 2 years, or 10 years prior to this.
It's also known as Bay of Blood.
Yeah.
So it's referred to as both those. But some of the other kills, just so we can cover those bases.
Yeah, Scott, who is the perv who's hitting on Terry, steps into a rope that has him hanging upside down.
Mm-hmm.
Terry goes to get a knife to cut him down. Meanwhile, Jason appears and slits his throat with a machete.
The first machete kill.
Yeah. Terry comes and finds Scott. She starts screaming, turns around to face the camera, and the scene cuts. She's screaming as she faces the camera. Yeah. We don't actually see her get killed. Mark goes searching for Vicky. This is the wheelchair kill. Jeff gets a spear in the back on top of Sandra. Ted is left at the bar. We just mentioned Ted is left at the bar. Vicky walks into Sandra and Jeff's room. We got real acclimated during the first 30 minutes when we're introducing these characters.
They're very relatable. I feel like they're
Sandra
my friends.
Sandra became Sandy to me. Vicky walks into Sandra and Jeff's room, pulls back the covers of the bed to find Jason there, to which she like screams.
Yeah.
He slices her leg. She steps back to find Jeff's dead body. She's then stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see any penetration of the stab.
Yes.
But
we saw no penetration in this movie.
There was no penetration in this movie. I had a boner to pick with this thing.
Yes. Well, quite tisk,
yes.
Tisk.
Yes.
But then Paul and Jenny come back and the lights
now
are
we're
out
at this point.
Well, they say the lights are out, but they lit the scene too well.
We're getting into the climax of the movie.
Yeah. And it's one of the more startling things is while Jenny and Paul they first see, like, they enter the cabin and they go upstairs and they know something's afoot when they see there's blood splatter all over the bed.
Like, is this a prank?
Yeah. But when they're downstairs, Jenny sees a shadow walking up and, you know, she says, "Paul, there's someone fucking here."
Yeah.
And, they tussle. And
to which you see during this final kind of pursuit, to which Paul technically survives.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some allusion to the end that there's some sort of dream quality to it, and he's gone.
Yeah.
But he survives, technically. But what's different about this one, even 3 and 4, because 4 was supposed to be the final chapter.
Right.
And we'll get more
into
detail.
We'll talk more about that.
It was supposed to be the last movie. It effectively ends Jason as a human.
Yeah.
Because even though he's this force of nature, he's still a human, and that's none more evident than in this movie. You see him struggling around in a tussle with Paul.
He's clumsy.
He's clumsy. He's got like a rake, mm-hmm. like a farmer's rake mm-hmm. that he's, but a chair, the chair he's standing on mm-hmm. breaks under his weight. And yeah. so he, you know, Jenny corners
yeah.
him with a chainsaw and he's like cowering in fear mm-hmm. and stuff. He's still a monstrous human, but he's still a human.
Mm-hmm.
He's much thinner than other representatives. Steve Dash was only 5'11" and he was 175 pounds, which for 5'11", that's not like super skinny, but that's thin.
Yeah.
So like he's a thinner. He's not this beast or animal he is yeah. in other movies where he's portrayed by 6'4", you know, guys. He's a lumbering, clumsy oaf
yeah.
who he's still powerful. He still yeah. has the ability to kill, but yeah. like Jenny's running from him mm-hmm. at one point. He jumps out from the woods and completely misses her mm-hmm. and biffs it, you know? Yeah. So he's able to be taken down
yeah.
by characters and unlike in later installments where yeah. he punches people's heads off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which Jason Takes Manhattan is
a boring,
is a shitty movie.
It is
actually
so boring.
I was about to say, it's a movie called Jason Takes Manhattan, and roughly 15 minutes of the movie actually take place in Manhattan.
Yeah.
That's a bit of an exaggeration. Well, physically, the movie itself takes place in Manhattan like the last half an hour, but yeah. they only got like, they can only film in Manhattan for a little bit.
So most of it's Vancouver.
Yeah.
Vancouver
Jason
for Vancouver.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The Vancouver. Knucklehead Jason.
Yeah, baby.
Jason but, and the Knuckleheads.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Not really, but no, but Harry Manfredini's score
is still excellent.
It stand out. It builds tension and suspense in mm-hmm. like the quieter parts yeah. when he's stalking them. And then when during chase scenes mm-hmm. it's like pulse pounding
yeah.
kind of music.
That's something that also is done well in this one is there's these POV, and I've said voyeur already a couple yeah. times, but these POV voyeuristic shots that sometimes you kind of know it's the killer, Jason. Yeah. Sometimes it's revealed that it's like from a different character's perspective. And it's yeah. supposed to be like this jump scare of, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, like the cop.
Yeah.
When Sandra and Jeff are mm-hmm. looking at what they think is the dog Muffins, who's mm-hmm. introduced, and it appears as though Muffins gets killed by Jason.
Yeah,
which is a funny edit when like Muffin runs off in the woods and she's at the feet of these booted feet of someone, and it's Jason.
She looks up, and then it cuts to one of the counselors is like grilling hot dogs, mm-hmm. and you see it's just a shot of a hot dog on a grill. Mm-hmm. So that's a funny
it's
edit.
It's very funny.
But when Sandra and Jeff see mm-hmm. it, and the cop comes up, yeah. and you see a hand come in, it's like, what are you doing?
It's like, that's yeah. my lunch.
Oh, yeah. But
yeah, it doesn't say that. But the cop's an idiot
yeah,
in this movie.
But one of the kills was the cop gets the back end of a hammer in his head
because yeah.
he goes snooping into the woods because he's in his patrol car and he sees a figure running into the woods.
It's like, what the hell?
Yeah, which within the realm of the movie, he's trying to protect that area. So, of course, yeah. he wants, hey, what are you doing? He goes, runs off. But the viewer is like, me, every time I watch that, I'm like, well, that was strange. Well, back to the station.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll probably get a call from one of these counselors, and I'll come back out when we have something confirmed.
Yeah.
But no, this dumpy police officer pursues him through the woods, mm-hmm. finds his shack, and gets the back of a hammer to the head.
Yeah. But back to the shack,
yeah.
if you will, to the love shack baby.
Yeah, because Jenny's running through the woods, and she's like, oh, thank God, help, help.
Yeah,
you know,
she finds herself in the shack. This is where
she doesn't know it's Jason.
Yeah, exactly. Until in the back room, she sees the severed head of Mrs. Mm-hmm. Voorhees and like a shrine with also three bodies
and the sweater she was
yeah
killed
the
in.
Sweater she was killed in, which leads to what you mentioned earlier, how she's going to use her child psychology sensibilities.
Yeah,
she maybe if he's waiting for her to return, mm-hmm. maybe I can convince him she's returned.
Yeah,
and so she stands in front of the severed head, puts the sweater on, tucks her hair into the sweater, and she's like, it's like, mother, Jason's here.
Mm-hmm.
Or no, Jason, mother's here now. Mm-hmm. Like, mother is Jason. Mother is talking to you. Like
yeah.
as he starts to kind of approach her, like yeah. mother's talking to you,
and that's where
and he like tilts his head, like mom.
Yeah, like this mirage of Betsy Palmer.
Yeah,
who returns. It's just her head.
Yeah,
and that's what Jason sees when the audience sees Jenny.
Yeah,
so and she almost gets away with it.
Yeah, because she took the machete that was mm-hmm. also at her shrine, mm-hmm. and she's got it behind her back while she's doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is to get Jason in such a vulnerable position to where she can, bam, bring that baby down mm-hmm. on him.
and she almost does it, kind of like you were saying.
But she moves over slightly over to her right, and Jason sees the head there and realizes it was a ruse.
Yeah.
And he brings his
pickaxe.
His pickaxe up just in time for Jenny to
whack it.
To whack it, and he blocks the shot. And
Paul shows up.
Paul, who did not die.
Yeah.
Paul shows up, and he tussles with him again. And as Jason's about to kill Paul, she has the opportunity to bring the machete down right into his shoulder.
Yeah,
and
which we're assuming connected with his heart, because I don't think that would have killed him unless he bled out.
So he falls to the ground. Before that, he had stabbed or sliced Jenny, and Jenny and Paul are headed back to the camp. They find their way back into a room. The same kind of serene music is playing.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't start playing yet because
they hear a noise. She's sitting there with the like the farmers, the metal rake.
Yeah.
And Paul is has another. I think he's got the pickaxe. Or he's got something.
He has some sort of blunt instrument that.
Yeah.
The music is building, and
mm-hmm.
so he's approaching the door, and it's like, what is
it?
What is it? And open it. And it's Muffin.
It's Muffin.
It's the dog Muffin.
And they're like, Muffin, come here, Muffin. And as Jenny stands up.
Yeah, surprise. Yeah,
it's the serene music, the same kind of like serene music you have that lowers your guard, like in the first one. Mm-hmm. And then smash through the wall and in the window is
unmasked Jason.
Which
so
we
see
his deformed, monstrous face.
And then it's, you know, takes Jenny by surprise. It's the suspenseful music. And then we have another, it's in slow-mo, and then we have another edit to where we see Jenny being carted off on a gurney into the back of the paddy wagon.
An ambulance.
A meat wagon.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, come on.
The back of a meat wagon.
Yeah.
She's like, Paul, where's Paul?
To which we are also like, yeah, what the hell is happening? Where's Paul?
Yeah. And then
so I guess we're supposed to, this was all a dream.
It was all a dream.
Yeah, exactly.
But the cars then drive off,
and
that's the end of Friday the 13th, part two.
Yeah, we get a zoom in of her severed head
Mrs. Voorhees' severed head,
and then it fades out and credits.
Yep, it's a nice sequel. It's fine.
It plays it safe as a sequel. Well, I mean, I guess if you're doing such a huge time jump, the best you can do is like let's make it was as close to the first one as you're going to get in terms of the format of the counselors and the stalking and kind of it was not as gruesome as the later movies would be and other movies of other like slashers of this time were already doing.
Yeah.
So kind of like we mentioned, it was just kind of makeup effects artists just flexing their muscles and getting a chance to have fun kind of thing.
Absolutely serviceable. It's a fun entry. Apparently it's polarizing with diehard fans. I like it. It's
really?
Fine.
I think
because it played so safe, so close to the first one, and they're so used
whatever.
To they're so used to what they like.
Yeah.
I think the third one revs it up, amps it up.
Yeah.
Brings
it's in 3D.
Yeah. Which we'll get to. The third one is one of the I think that's the first one I ever really watched.
Yeah.
And it was on Monster Fest on AMC.
That's the thing with these. That's why when I say we're horror fans, but we're horror fans during this time of year.
Yeah.
And it's really only like the big ones that permeated pop culture with the occasional like, oh, I want to watch Hellraiser. I want to watch Candyman.
I like the B ones, the B horror movies from the 80s. Like around this time of year, it amps it up. It's when I like it the best. But as the year goes on, if I see something about like an old 80s, you know, campy slasher movie, it piques my interest because, I mean, I love 80s movies. I love riffable things. I love B-rated things.
Not just B-rated horror movies, but sequels to B-rated, like Sleepaway Camp, Sleepaway Camp 2, Sleepaway Camp 3.
So that type of stuff, it's just... I think I'm still hesitant to call myself a horror fan, although I like a lot of horror things.
And you mentioned Fear Fest. We didn't grow up watching these movies, grew up terrified of these movies. It wasn't until we got a little older we started to take the power away from them and make these characters buffoons and make fun of these movies because of Fear Fest. Fear Fest, we'd only have any interest in watching them because of Fear Fest, which only came on around this time of year.
Yeah.
So because around this time of year, I really only like watching horror movies. And it was the big ones that they showed primarily.
Yeah.
But it was the sequels.
Yeah.
So they almost always showed Friday the 13th 3 through 7, mm-hmm. 3 through 8, Halloween, yeah. 4, Halloween 5, and stuff, yeah. like that. So something like 2 is synonymous with me for like college, especially, yeah. Because they didn't show 2 a lot until a certain, mm-hmm. time, and then they started showing 2,
but
and then
you heard about it,
yeah, oh yeah,
because you do, because we, once we get into something, we got to learn like everything about,
yeah.
it. So we did a lot of independent research in high school before, mm-hmm. we watched any of these,
yeah.
And then 2 would be shown on TV, because like I always be like, oh well, I want to watch 2.
Yeah.
So then 2 would came on, started coming on TV, and I put it on, and it's synonymous with me with like those years in college, yeah. still at mom and dad's.
Yeah.
And you put it on and listen to music or something like that. You know, you're winding down the night and you want to watch something spooky, so you put on 2, and 2's, yeah. on. So it's nice, I think, with how over the top these would get, it kind of gets lost in the shuffle because it is so close to 1.
It's a bit more grounded.
Yeah, I still like 2.
Yeah.
Like I mentioned earlier, it seems like it still tries to be a movie.
Yeah. Jenny's definitely the best heroine of the whole series.
Oh, yeah. Yep. There's definitely that difference of not only is she trying to understand Jason,
yeah.
she also is shown to be a strong character in multiple ways, not,
yeah.
just intelligently, but also,
yeah.
she holds her own with Jason.
Yeah.
Now, as Jason becomes more of a brute, there needs to be more savvy ways for the heroine to deal with him.
Telekinesis.
Telekinesis, like in the 7th one, which we won't
you
be talking
think
about
I'm
this year.
You think I'm joking? Nope.
That's the big thing with Tina. She's a telekinesis. She's one of them telekinesis girls.
Yeah. In 6, literally a bolt of lightning brings him back, yep. to life.
Which we'll get to that.
Yeah.
6 is
my favorite.
Which we mentioned
easily.
When we ranked them.
Yeah.
But that's it for 2.
Yeah.
2 is great. Let us know if you like Friday the 13th Part 2. Let us know your feelings on it on our social media. But, you know, 5 Weeks of Fright is now in full swing.
Mm.
Very excited to visit the other entries we talked about and to get back to doing a 6,
yeah.
mix.
We're going
to
get another tale from our Hillbilly Horror
next week. Yes, exactly. But until then,
be good to yourselves, be good to each other, because why would you want to be rude when you could be rad? We'll see you next time.